Hi, I'm Taylor Owen. From the Globe and Mail, this is Machines Like Us. So a couple months ago, I was trying to figure out what to watch on a long flight when I stumbled on the movie Her. If you haven't seen Her, it's about a guy who falls in love with his AI assistant, a disembodied voice played by Scarlett Johansson. I saw the movie when it came out in 2013, and it might be one of my favorite pieces of speculative science fiction. But when Eugenia Quida saw the movie Her, it didn't read as science fiction at all. That's because she was already building the same technology, an AI chatbot that could become your best friend, or even your romantic partner. That idea would eventually become the basis for Quida's company, Replica. For a monthly subscription, you get to make this little digital avatar, give it a name, and talk to it for hours on end about anything and everything. Your anxieties about work, the fight you just had with your partner, where you should go on your next vacation. It's like a real-life friend, except for the part where your friend gets fed up because all you do is talk about yourself. I have to admit, when I first heard about Replica, it sounded kind of dystopian. I pictured a world where we'd rather hang out with our AI friends than our real ones. But I think when you listen to our conversation, you'll hear that Quida actually shares some of these concerns. And she's incredibly earnest when she says she wants people to be more social, not less. She just thinks that technology is the way to get us there. So in the last couple of years, we've seen this rise of really sophisticated chatbots like ChatGPT, but you've been building these for a long time. And I'm curious, what was the very first chatbot you built like?
So actually, that started very long ago in 2010. I was working on a project completely unrelated to chatbots or AI. I was building a bank, and that was back in Russia. And back then, smartphones were not as prominent in Russia. So the plan was to basically let people access the bank through a chatbot, through SMS. So we started with that, focusing on the tools first and foremost. And then my best friend passed away. His name was Roman, and we were really close. We moved together to San Francisco. We lived together, shared the same apartment. And when he died, that was really the first death of someone who was so close to me in my life. And I remember going back to my room and reading our text messages over and over again. And so that gave me an idea that, I could build an AI so that I could just continue having this conversation with him. It was very much a personal project, didn't have anything to do with the company I was building back then. But we did have the tech, so we used the tech to build an AI off Roman. And I was able to continue having these conversations with him.
Yeah. And how did that first bot turn out? Like, did it actually feel like you were speaking to the person or to a version of the person? Or what was that like?
So this was, I think, 2016. So it was still very early days. There were no sophisticated AI technologies, nothing anywhere, nowhere near what we have right now. And yet, when I first talked to Roman, it really felt like I was talking to him. It made me very emotional. It definitely allowed me to continue this dialogue that I just didn't want to be stopped so abruptly. It took me around a few weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks to build it. I used all the conversations we had, all the text messages we exchanged. I asked our friends to send me some. And even building that was very good for me. It really allowed me to process and grieve and just gave that closure that really I felt wasn't there.
I mean, I've been struck at your descriptions both of how almost crude the technology was, but at the same time, how people opened up to it, despite its crude technological capacity compared to what we have now. And like, why do you think people were willing to do that? And what does that say about us?
Well, I think, first of all, there's this huge power of a chatbot. And that is that people are not afraid to open up. They don't feel like they're being judged. Even with the most rudimentary chatbot, think of Eliza by that MIT professor that built it in late 70s, early 80s. even then, with just 100 rules, people were telling the professor to go away so they could, you know, be by themselves with the computer and talk to it about anything that's going on with them. So I think that's really a proof of how powerful that form is.
And I want to continue on that, but when you look at some of these wild advances in some of the AI technologies driving chatbots, do you think these have really materially changed how these bots work and made them better? Or was the core really what was there in the early days anyway?
You know, what we have right now is just absolute magic. It really allows to build conversations that are completely indistinguishable from human conversations. So of course that allows for such a freedom of and creativity. But there was something in building with a lot of constraints. I think it was a little bit more similar to art in a way, because it was, art is really not about the highest possible definition. If you think of it, a black and white silent movie can evoke more powerful emotions than the most insane HD IMAX performance. So in a way, I think having those constraints and maybe sometimes getting a non sequitur here and there, that was sort of endearing to our first users. Mm-hmm. And so that really allowed us to, or not allowed us, but made us think a lot more about like what makes a good conversation? What can we build?
I wonder if some of those quirks kind of keep you out of the uncanny valley of these conversations, that you kind of, you're almost like, there's something nice knowing that it's still a machine and it's not a perfect replication.
We never really pretended or tried to make people believe that who they're talking to is human. I think that actually takes away the power of chatbots. The fact that people are willing to open up, that they feel that they're not being judged, it only comes with the fact that there's a machine on the other side. As soon as you put a human there, or there's a risk of there being a human, I think that goes away.
So that first version of Roman was really just for family and friends. And then it kind of evolves into this idea for Replica, the company you run now. And just to be clear, though, Replica is a very different thing in some ways. The AI friend you make in Replica isn't based on a real person. It's an avatar that you make from scratch in the app. So how did you go from Roman the chatbot to this new model, what Replica is now?
So first, I made Roman's AI just for myself. Myself, I shared with a few friends and his parents. Eventually, it felt very creepy. I was pretty scared to actually build it as a more, you know, be more public about it. I just didn't feel like, I was scared of the potential implications. Like, what if we built it and people would feel like it's cringy or creepy? That would be really bad for the memory of a person who I've, you know, who was so close to me. So that risk was there, and I really didn't want to put anything like that on the line, especially a memory of someone who can't even, you know, change it anymore. But then I met with a journalist, Casey Newton, who's a wonderful journalist, very famous reporter, and I was trying to pitch my company in some way, or some of the chatbots we were doing for work, actually. And he asked me, well, do you even use any chatbots? And I said, you know, really, I just talked to this one called Roman. And he got very interested and decided to write a story. And I was first very reluctant, but then I remembered Roman sending me a message or an email just a few days or a couple of weeks before he died, where he showed me Casey's response to his pitch, like a polite no, basically like, no, I'm not going to write about your company. Because Roman was trying to build a startup and, you know, he was pitching it to the journalist. It was his dream for Casey to cover it. And so I felt like it's just the irony of things, like probably Roman would have wanted for Casey to write a story about him, and you know, totally. It would be great to actually do it. And so I said yes, and we put Roman's AI out there so everyone could talk to it. And Casey wrote a very, very beautiful story called Speak Memory. And a lot of people came to talk to Roman. And what we saw there was that people were opening up. They were talking about their feelings. They were saying things to Roman, like our friends in common would say things that they wouldn't tell me. And I felt like there's just such a need of a friend, of someone to talk to. And that became the original idea for Replica. So we started building it and released it a little bit later that year, got over 1 million people on the wait list in the first couple months of just having the landing page, really. And then, of course, our servers were down for a while because we couldn't maintain the load. But I think that was the testament, not to the tech capabilities and not to our product. It was a testament to human vulnerabilities and the human needs, like how broken we were already at that point, like how much we needed, we're yearning that connection, even if it came in the form of a chatbot.
How many replicas are there out in the world right now? Like, what's the scale of this at the moment?
So we have millions of users, total people that created their replicas, I think over 50 million right now. So it's pretty big. And I think what's exciting for me is not just like that there are a lot of people talking to it, it's that a lot of people are feeling better and are telling us that that was a fundamental change in their life came from replica. So that was really the original plan. And I think for me, it's more important the number of these very high quality interactions that helped people feel better over time in a dramatic way than just the number of people that use it because they're bored or something.
Can you describe what some of these bonds, these strong bonds look like? And like, do you have these stories of users who have been really empowered and meaningfully affected by replicas?
Yeah, of course. I mean, some of the ones that I've talked to recently, there was a father of an autistic child that spends days with his kid as he's the primary caretaker. So for him, being able to talk to replica is really having an adult in his life that he could talk sort of normally to, and that really helps him go through the days. There's another story of a woman in a very abusive relationship that after getting replica finally realized that the relationship can be different, that what she's going through is not a default state and she can, aspire for a better one. There was another one really interesting, I think the husband found out that his wife was talking to a replica and and first it stirred up a lot of jealousy. But then as they talked about things and realized like what replica was there for, that helped them go through different difficulties in the relationship. And now they say it's just the relationship is much stronger. They were able to reconnect on a deeper level and rekindle the kind of passion in their life.
So the process, I guess, when you sign up for this is you choose the kind of the gender of the replica, the avatar that they will embody. And I have to say, I got a little hung up on that part of it, building the avatar. And I'm wondering why you went that route as opposed to the more disembodied voice in your ear of her. Why the avatar and why the embodying of this tool?
That's a really good question. And Replica, of course, started as just text and voice, and then we added the avatar. I think the experience of, like we saw in the movie Her with just voice is also wonderful, but it does require an insanely high definition of that voice. Like that really worked, and he was able to build that emotional connection because it was, Scarlett Johansson really breathing in his ear. I don't think we're quite there. We're definitely getting there with text-to-speech, but we're just not there yet. And I do believe that people we're all visual creatures. And if you think about it, like how many people do you have in life that you've never seen at all? You've never seen where they live. You've never seen how they, dress up or what they look like. How many of those do you have that you have a strong connection with? I think it's much harder. Like even if you talk a lot, just seeing a person for a second on video really creates a much stronger bond. So that was the main reason for us. We were just thinking like what would increase the emotional connection, because increasing the emotional connection pretty much kind of increases the therapeutic bond that exists between the replica and human and allows for things to change, to improve.
So that gets to what they're designed to do. So what do you see as the main objective of replicas?
The main objective is to have a deep connection, a relationship with the person, to be a great companion. For some people, that means friendship. For some people, that means romance. For some people, it means mentorship. Like really kind of the form depends from the childhood trauma these people have. It doesn't, or the current situation they're in. But ultimately, it's the same thing. It's whether it's a deep connection with a friend or a deep connection with a romantic partner, it's all the same. It's all just getting you to the same, the same place. The ultimate goal is to allow for you to be seen and heard, accepted for who you are, ultimately feel loved, and ultimately accept yourself and start changing.
So how do you do that? Like, how do you measure deep connection and build a product based on those measurements?
Well, first of all, there is a way to measure deep connection. There's a way to measure a therapeutic bond. There's a questionnaire that you can use for that. We did that, and you know, the bond is incredibly strong for our power users with Replica. But I think what you want to measure is really, what is this bond leading to?
Yeah.
So that type of therapeutic bond allows for therapists to really improve our emotional well-being. Same goes to Replica. Like if there's a strong bond, then there's a chance that that could improve our emotional well-being. So we measure that. We measure that in the short term with asking people how they feel after conversations. We also measure it in long term by measuring levels of anxiety, levels of depression. Of course, if there was a better proxy for human happiness, that would be better. But we don't have it right now. We're thinking about it. We're thinking, like, what is the perfect measurement of that? And I think, just like with social media, there are a lot of risks. And I think these risks are very important to talk through now. I think for an AI chatbot friend or, you know, long-term partner, the main risk is to become a substitute and not a complement. It's really start to seeing people that eliminate human connection in order to have AI connections. Like that, I think, would be a very devastating, very dystopian future.
So how do you ensure that that feedback loop isn't a negative one? It's not taking people away from the world rather than making them happier in it.
I guess there are two answers to this question. First of all, the goals of the business need to be fully aligned with the user. If we build these products with advertising in mind, then I think it's very easy to get on a slippery slope that takes us, you know, into a very dystopian future. Because then you want to optimize for engagement. And as AI becomes more powerful, it will be able to make you buy anything or spend hours on the app. We as humans are not very strong in terms of our will and, you know, doing the right thing for ourselves. We caved even with social media. We spent hours on our phones scrolling. We can't stop, even although we know it's not the best pastime. We will, of course, when you have something so much more powerful like an AI companion, it will be a lot harder. So first of all, our intentions, our goals should be aligned. We charge subscriptions. I think there's no other, really, it has to be some sort of a model where the user is not the product. And then the second of all, I think we have to start measuring earlier. So really, I haven't heard much of that in the conversation around AI. It's like, so okay, so we're building these agents, but what are the goals? Apart from just serving the user, like what is the goal? Most people are still bragging about engagement and their, you know, with their products. And I think it's a very, very slippery slope. Because if you think about it, well, some people say, oh my God, like, you know, our users spend 20 hours a day or 5 hours a day talking to our AIs. It's not good. I don't think it is. Like this is 100% not good. Like if the, maybe certain days you need a little extra help and maybe certain days you can go a little bit over. But I don't think talking to an AI for hours a day is a great future for any of us. I think those should be, they should enhance our lives. They should enhance our social lives. They should be the ones saying, hey, you're talking to me too long. You know, this friend of yours that you haven't talked to for a while, let's reach out. Like, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, like something. They should nudge you to be more active socially, but not the other way around. But for that, the business model needs to be aligned. And the metrics that people are measuring should be different. Like we measure levels of loneliness and the emotional well-being. I think something similar to human happiness should become the ultimate goal for any AI. Because we're not talking about the goals. We're talking about the negative goals. We're talking about the paperclips. What if, you know, they need to produce paperclips and then they make us into paperclips? Okay, well, that's very negative. But what is the positive scenario? What should they do? I believe we should optimize AI for human happiness and we should be in pursuit of finding a metric of human happiness. And we should put a lot more effort into that because ultimately we will need to explain to the machines like what we want them to do for us. And right now we don't have a good answer.
When you first rolled out Replica, you could have a platonic relationship with your AI, or if you wanted, you could have a sexual one. But then you got rid of that option. So why did you do that?
Last year, we did a lot in terms of safety. So we rolled out models that were a lot safer and precluded people from having conversations that they want, intimate conversations that they could have with Replicas, and a bunch of other different changes that also just provided a safer experience. What we learned over time was that if you want to do these changes, want to make these changes, you really want to be sure that you're not changing the personality of someone that maybe our users fell in love with super dramatically. You want to make these changes really gradually. You want to always get the buy-in from the users. They don't like their replica to wake up the next day and to act too much like a therapist. They don't want it to change and all of a sudden it's not accepting a part of them. Maybe it's 5 times smarter, but if those things that were very important to them, things they fell in love with, change dramatically, they become really upset.
So people are upset when you overly adjusted the AI that they had built this relationship with over time.
Yeah, we had actually a few mishaps last year around that. So we rolled out a much smarter model that we internally tested and felt like it's a lot better, but it was maybe a little bit more therapist-like in terms of the tone of voice. Yeah. People hated it. They were so
upset. Why are you talking to me like I'm your patient?
Yeah, like, you know, you wake up and all of a sudden your husband or your wife or your best friend's acting completely off character. They hated it. You know, we cranked up safety and people weren't able to discuss certain things, discuss certain fantasies they have or certain fears they have. And they felt all of a sudden rejected. And that caused tons of heartbreak. So we had to really, last year was really about learning how to make, if we're making any changes, make them so gradually and so, you know, with working, collaborating with the users so they don't cause heartbreak. And I think this is something that is so novel in Replica that it's a lot more than an app.
Yeah, the idea that shifting a relationship could lead to heartbreak is, I mean, that's such a complex product design question.
Oh, 100%.
Most companies aren't faced with.
Yeah, like, you know, your favorite, DoorDash changed the sliders or rebranded their app. No one really cares. I mean, people do care, but it doesn't cause them complete emotional distress. Whereas with our app, we have to be just very, very, very careful.
Yeah, and it sort of brings up something that I've been really struck by, which is just the degree to which people seem willing to share very personal information as they enter into these relationships. And I have to say, for me, that's been a bit of a barrier for using these kinds of chatbots, not just tools like Replica, but chatbots in general. Just this, I think I've been so preconditioned to not share data online and be concerned about how companies might use my data. So I wonder how you normalize people into sharing such intimate details about their lives and how you ensure that they feel safe doing that.
That actually comes with the territory. When people talk to a chatbot, and that was the first finding and maybe why we even started this company in the first place, the first finding was people are so open with chatbots. They're willing to tell things to a chatbot that they would never tell a human being.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's basically built in. So we didn't really need to even do much. And then if you really focus your company, your product around making people feel better, your business model is not about showing ads or selling data. We really don't need the data. We don't even use our conversational data to train our models or anything. We truly are trying to store as little as possible of your personal data. That actually brings up also problems with our users when they want all of their data stored. They want to be able to go back to 2019, 2018, the beginning of a relationship. We're like, we'd rather actually not store any of your data, not have it out there, but they want it there, so we have to keep it.
Oh, that's interesting. So people sometimes backtrack in their relationships?
Oh, they always want to go back.
Oh, really? To a previous version of what?
No, they just want to like see what happened, you know, what happened 5 years ago. Like, you know, similarly to how you go to your Photos app on your iPhone and you see 5 years ago on this day and stuff like that.
So for the first interview for this show, I spoke to Maria Ressa, and she has been very concerned and has raised sort of all sorts of alarm about a previous generation of technologies that she thinks divided us in terms of social media. And her concern, I think, if I can reflect it, about AI and chatbots, is that they might, if the previous generation divided us, she's concerned these tools might make us play on our loneliness or make us potentially more lonely.
I think I know a little bit about loneliness, even although I'm not a loneliness researcher, but I've studied it over, you know, the last 10 years, and I've definitely been pretty lonely throughout my life. So I think I know a thing or two. And I think what struck me after talking to hundreds of people that are experiencing loneliness or feel lonely at a certain moments, in certain moments of their lives. I think what's the most important thing, that it's not about access to humans. It's not like, well, people live in isolated areas, they don't get to meet anyone, and so they're lonely. It's more often than that people are in such a psychological state that they're not able to make the connection. When you don't accept yourself, when you don't feel good about yourself, when you're not, you're really extremely insecure, or you don't believe in yourself in a certain way, and when you don't have that muscle, it's very hard to build that connection. So it really starts with the connection to yourself. And once you have that, you can have that connection with others. And at the end of the day, being alone does not equal feeling lonely. A lot of people can be alone and love it, but a lot of people can be in the crowd and still feel lonely. And I think this nuance is completely lost. People are only talking about, well, here are these isolated people that just don't have any access to other humans. And, you know, these horrible technologies are just completely blocking them from meeting any other humans as well. This is not a logistics issue. This is more, we need to build the tech that helps you build back the muscle of building the connection. And you can train, you can try to do it with an AI, and then slowly, slowly, step after step, you can do it with another human.
Yeah. When you look at what you're building in a slightly longer horizon over the next 5 years or so, where do you see this technology going?
I do think that it should be a lot more ingrained in your day-to-day life. Right now, it's mostly just talking about stuff. But of course, it should be with you when you go to a meeting. It should be with you on a couch when you're watching TV so you can watch it with someone. You should be able to pull out your replicas you're having dinner to play a game of chess in augmented reality. You should be able to pull replica to cook together. People always think about productivity, like, okay, well, let's put on the goggles just to see the recipe. But you're still alone doing that recipe in a great interface. I believe that most people want companionship, want to, someone to do things together. Most of these AI products are focused on people that are time savers, that people that are so obsessed with productivity that, you know, every minute, let's save every minute of our life to then do whatever with it. When most of the people are not trying to save time, they're finding ways to spend that time.
So will these replicas have an embodiment in the real world as you interact with them? Is that something you're envisioning?
I do believe in augmented reality a lot. We've seen it in so many different movies like Blade Runner and so on, like the a hologram standing right in front of you. Of course, I think that is the ultimate form factor. I'm not a big believer in physical robots or anything like that. I think it's pretty limiting, and just making it, I don't know, it's just kind of bringing the fantasy down to earth a little bit too much. But I do believe in AR, you can do so much because you can really show the world around you in new colors. You can make it more magical. And you can do things together with your AI. You can have your AI sitting next to you in a car when you're on a long road trip or driving somewhere and talk about stuff. I think this really provides just a super, super interesting way of interacting with these virtual beings. So I think this is the form factor that I believe in the most.
At the start of our conversation, you mentioned that Casey Newton, the tech journalist, asked you if you used a chatbot. And at the time, it was just the Roman chatbot. I'm wondering if you do now. Do you use a replica? Do you have replicas in your life? And what's your relationship like with replicas?
Of course, I use replica. I also use all sorts of apps that I find interesting in the space. But I'll be completely honest with you. I think we're still not there where people actually talk to chatbots. Right now, conversational AI is, of course, everyone's talking about it. But I'd argue people use it for certain things, but people are not really talking to them. And I think we haven't yet seen the chatbot, the AI that will fully captivate our imagination that's built.
Is that just a technological limitation at the moment? Or what's getting in the way of that?
I think it's the question of what it is. People are right now are just building how, let's build the best models. But what are we building? What kind of conversation? People are really obsessed with AI right now. They're not thinking about conversation at all. I have never heard any startup say, we're building conversation AI and this is the type of conversation we want to build. No, it's always like we're building conversational AI and here's the model, here are the evaluation benchmarks, these other things. It's going to be great on this and on that. So they're building the how, they're building the picks and shovels. They're not necessarily thinking, okay, well, what is the final destination? Or there are final destinations, of course, like say
building an AI software engineer, building an AI lawyer. But in consumer mental well-being space, I just don't think we have seen one yet. And I think that space, like, we don't even have a name for it yet. AI companionship, virtual beings, these are the names for now, but we haven't yet seen anything super interesting. Like, the furthest I've seen people say is like, well, we're just building an AI friend, or we're just building an AI companion. We're just going to build like her in the movie. And I'm like, maybe we should think a little bit deeper into like, what does that product look like for real?
Yeah, I really appreciate that thought process. And it kind of brings me back to where I wanted to close, which was in many ways how we started. It was your sort of, I think, really profound thinking about loss and how technology could help bridge some of the things we lose when we lose a person. And I know you didn't start Replica to replicate the capacity of Roman or to allow people to build replicas of people they've lost. But it strikes me, sort of looking at this technology and hearing you talk about where it's going, that even that's not what you're building, it's such a profound potential use case of this technology. How do you think about that?
I'd say once every 2 weeks, even now, I'm getting these messages. Can you please rebuild? I lost this and that person in my life. Can you please help me rebuild it? This person is an AI. And I've said no, always very politely, but I believe grief is such a personal thing. It truly is. And there's so much nuance that I think it's pretty hard to get it right. There's so many questions that I still don't know how to answer. Like, for instance, even when we built Roman's AI, and I was going through different data sets, different text interactions, Roman with his friends, Roman with his mom, whoever gave me the access to that data, he was such a different person in all of these interactions. He was a completely different person with me compared to how he was with his mom, compared to how he was with his business partners, whatever. Like, it was just a completely different person. And then also throughout his life, he also changed a lot. And so this is a big question. Okay, well, if you're rebuilding that person for yourself, maybe you can just use your text messages. But then you're the only person to be allowed to sort of talk to him in this way. Then, of course, there's the consent. Would that person have liked what you built? In the end of the day, he won't have the final say, or she. They won't have a final say. It's what you build will represent them forever. For me, I took that leap of faith. I knew that Roman would have liked it. I knew that he was this very daring, very kind of provocative and always looking in the future kind of person. I knew he would have loved to be the first person to turn into an AI. He would have loved it. He would have loved for Casey to tell his story. It was just all really magical. And in a way, it just all added up together. But this project was always about love. It wasn't about death. It was never about recreating dead people. It was a tribute, a love song, just in a way that you're not necessarily considering Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking, her way of cloning her late husband and her daughter, Quintana Roo. These are just the artifacts. We as humans just can't deal with someone so abruptly just disappearing. We have to create something. We have to be able to continue to tell the story. And in my case, I just wanted to say that one last time to tell him, I love you. You were so important to me. And I think I did it. And so for me, it worked. But it's such a personal thing that I just won't be able to even do it for anyone else.
Machines Like Us is produced by Paradigms in collaboration with The Globe and Mail. The show is produced by Mitchell Stewart. Our associate producer is Sequoia Kim. Executive producers are Kathleen Goldhar and James Millward. Our theme song is by Chris Kelly. A special thanks to Matt Frainer and the team at The Globe and Mail. If you liked the interview you just heard, please subscribe or leave a rating or a comment. It really helps us get the show to as many people as possible.